Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
A colossal monster, a city in ruins, no way out, except inside of the all-electric Toyota CHR. John Cho stars in Escape. Test drive Toyota's new all-electric family today. Toyota, let's go places.
This week, a former teacher's murder trial ends in a mistrial. A school shooter pleads guilty as emotional victims confront him in court. Shocking new evidence is revealed in the David hearing. And one of the year's biggest trials is finally about to begin. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. Okay, y'all. First, let's get into the verdicts that were reached this week. We have a quick update on the Kiana Davis case that we talked about last week. Now, Kiana is the former Georgia teacher who was charged in the November 2020 death of her two-year-old son, Carter Ambrose. Carter was taken to his pediatrician's office unresponsive, and although he had a history of health problems, an autopsy determined that he died from blunt force trauma to his abdomen that lacerated his liver. Now, prosecutors argued that those injuries happened while Carter was in the exclusive care of Kiana and her then-boyfriend, Keon Benton. Now, the defense pushed back, saying that Carter had been a medically fragile child, and they questioned whether prosecutors could prove exactly when and how the injuries occurred. And they pointed out that Kiana was actually teaching during at least part of the time frame when they say that Carter could have sustained these injuries. Well, after days of deliberations, the jury could not reach a unanimous verdict on any of the seven charges. The divisions were different on every count, and there was a child cruelty charge that was reportedly split 11 to 1. Now, they didn't say 11 on which side and 1 on which side. They just said the split. And several of the murder and assault charges were much more evenly divided. But at least at one point, the court was told that there was one juror who was described as combative and had reportedly said that she would not change her mind in a million years. Now, Judge Catherine Lumsden sent the jury back to continue deliberating. But after they spent all day reviewing the evidence, the jurors said returning on Monday would not change the outcome. So the judge ultimately declared a mistrial on July 17th. Now, these are the ones, if you listened to last week's episode, this is the same case where the jurors were sending notes about one juror being combative and about the jury foreperson harassing them. And there was a lot of juror drama last week. So it's not too surprising that they came back and were not able to reach any unanimous decisions on any of the charges. And just to clarify, a mistrial is not the same thing as an acquittal. So Kiana has not been convicted, but she has also not been cleared. So the district attorney said that they have already said the state intends to retry this case once it's placed back on the trial calendar. Now, meanwhile, Keon Benton is still awaiting his own trial, which prosecutors say could begin as early as November. All right, another major development this week came out of Georgia in the Appalachie High School shooting case. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with this one, Winder is a small city about an hour northeast of Atlanta, and that's where the school is. It's about maybe 20 minutes north from where I grew up, and it's a really nice community. Now, on September 4th, 2024, prosecutors say that Colt Gray, who at the time was only 14 years old, walked into Appalachie High School armed with a rifle, killing two teachers, Richard or Ricky Aspinwall and Christina Irimi, and two 14-year-old students, Mason and Christian, before he was taken into custody. Nine others were wounded in the attack, making it one of the deadliest school shootings in Georgia's history. So here's where this story made even more headlines, y'all. After the shooting, Colt's father, Colin Gray, was charged with 29 felony counts. His father, including second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and cruelty to children. Now, two of those counts were later dropped. But prosecutors argued that Colin enabled access to the AR-15 rifle that authorities say Colt used during the attack. And they say that Colin, the dad, had all the necessary information to prevent this from happening, but he did nothing to prevent it. Now, there was body camera footage and there were text messages that actually showed that Colin was aware that his son was struggling with mental health. And there were also like school discipline records and prior threats that had been reported to the police. And there were even online searches where this father had done searches seeking help for quote unquote troubled teens. So with all of that, Colin still bought his son an AR-15 for Christmas. Now, the defense for Colin basically said that Colt did have behavioral challenges, but they said Colin was a single dad and he was just trying to navigate that and that he bonded with his son through hunting and target practice. So, in the closing arguments, the prosecutor said that the shooting lasted 41 seconds, but those 41 seconds forever altered the lives of the students of Appalachie High School and their parents and everyone in the community. But they argued that Colin Gray bears responsibility for the murders as well. Jurors deliberated during that trial for less than 2 hours before convicting Colin Gray of all 27 felony counts, and sentencing was deferred to a later date. Now, all of that was March of this year. So this week, Colt, who is now 16 years old, pleaded guilty to all 55 charges against him, including 4 counts of murder. Now, what stood out here is that Colt did not plead guilty as part of a negotiated plea deal with prosecutors. He just basically admitted his guilt, meaning the focus of the proceedings has now shifted entirely just to sentencing. Now, the judge will decide whether Colt spends the rest of his life in prison without the possibility of parole or whether he will get a life sentence but eventually be eligible for parole under Georgia law. Now, the sentencing hearing has been incredibly emotional. There have been family members, teachers, and student survivors that have taken the stand to describe how the shooting forever changed their lives. The widow of teacher Ricky Aspinwall spoke about the unimaginable grief that her family continues to carry and the trauma their two young daughters will live with for the rest of their lives. One student who survived the shooting described being shot multiple times, undergoing several surgeries, and spending nearly a year learning how to walk again. Other survivors recounted the sheer terror that they experienced as gunfire echoed through the halls, offering heartbreaking reminders that the impact of that day extends far beyond just the 4 lives that were lost. This hearing is expected to continue this week as the defense presents mitigating evidence from a psychologist, a juvenile detention staff, and Colt's grandmother before the judge ultimately decides Colt's sentence. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to FinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, let's move on to new charges that have been filed. And our first story is, y'all, this is one of those cases that really shows how someone can appear to just move on and build an entirely normal life while police kind of quietly continue searching for answers. This is the closing of a cold case, and this is kind of a wild one. Okay, so back in January of 2012, 32-year-old Iracema Chavez was found murdered inside her apartment in Arlington, Texas. Her teenage niece was the one who discovered her body. So sad. So Irasima had been stabbed more than 100 times. And according to her niece, there was so much blood that even the white walls were just covered. Now, investigators found no signs of forced entry, but surveillance footage from the apartment complex captured a person wearing baggy clothing and a baseball cap and a hoodie walking up the stairs to her apartment. Now, the person knocked on the door and appeared to exchange a few words with someone inside and then was allowed in. Now, that suggested that Irasima may have known her killer. But the most important piece of evidence was something very, very small. This is a single drop of fresh blood found on a television stand inside Irasima's bedroom. Now, testing confirmed that the blood did not belong to Irasima. It came from an unidentified Hispanic woman, presumably someone who had been injured during the attack. So investigators uploaded that DNA profile to CODIS, the National Law Enforcement DNA database, but there were no matches. So police released their surveillance footage and followed numerous leads, but they were never able to identify the person in that video. And as the years passed, the case eventually went cold. So in November of 2024, Arlington police brought the evidence to the FBI's Dallas field office to see whether this case might be a good candidate for investigative genetic genealogy. Now, this is the same kind of technology we've seen solve so many cold cases in recent years. Instead of relying only on a direct match in a criminal database, investigators can use DNA submitted to genealogy databases and trace family connections and begin building out a family tree. In April of 2026, that process gave investigators the name of a potential suspect, Myra Velasquez. Now, Myra is no stranger to Irasima. Police say that the two women had actually been very close friends. And at the time of the murder, Myra lived only a few miles from Irasima's apartment. And she was 27 years old back then. So investigators still needed to confirm that the DNA was actually Myra's. So they began following her, y'all. And in May, undercover officers reportedly watched her eat at a restaurant and then collected two plastic forks that she had left behind. The discarded forks were sent to a crime lab, and according to police, the DNA recovered from them matched the drop of blood found beside Irasima's body 14 years earlier. Now, Myra, who is now 42, was arrested on July 16th and charged with capital murder. Now, that higher charge is reportedly based on the allegation that Irasima was killed during the commission or attempted commission of a robbery. So Myra is currently being held without bond. But here's the part that kind of makes this story really weird, kind of surreal. During the 14 years that police were trying to identify Irasima's killer, Myra apparently just went on with her life. She was living her best life, y'all. She started a family, and she literally traveled around the world. She became a licensed real estate agent, won awards, and built a successful career. One former colleague described her as kind and polite and family-oriented and a sweet lady, quote-unquote sweet lady. Those were the exact words that were used. Someone that she could never imagine being accused of something like this. And now, after all those years, police say that the secret that she had allegedly been carrying was revealed by something that she couldn't outrun. Her own DNA left behind in a single drop of blood. So, investigators have not publicly identified a motive at this point, and Myra has not been convicted of this crime. But if the prosecution's allegations are true, this is a case that remained unsolved for 14 years. And now we have modern technology and two plastic forks that finally gave investigators the break that they had been waiting for. All right, now, our other new charges case. This one involves Andrew and Tristan Tate, two brothers who have built massive online followings over the past several years and have become some of the most controversial figures on social media. Now, Andrew Tate first gained public attention as a kickboxer and then as a contestant on the reality TV show Big Brother UK, although he only lasted 6 days on that show. Y'all, he made for good TV at first. He stirred up all kinds of drama and called people names and got involved in heated confrontations, all those things that you want to see on reality TV, right? But he was removed from the show after a video surfaced that appeared to show him hitting a woman with a belt. Now, Andrew later said that that video was edited to misrepresent the situation and that there was laughing in the video and nobody got hurt. But he said that that part didn't get shown. So they removed him from the show. Well, after this, Andrew basically reinvented himself as an online influencer. Lucky us. Now, through podcasts, videos, and paid online courses, he promoted what he calls traditional masculinity and a lavish lifestyle of expensive cars and private jets and luxury homes. Now, his content has attracted millions of followers, particularly young men, but it has also been widely criticized for promoting misogynistic views. For example, Andrew Tate has said that rape victims bear some responsibility for what happens to them. He has said that husbands own their wives. And he has said that depression isn't a real thing. Now, if you've seen the recent documentary about the Manosphere mentality on Netflix, yeah, that's Andrew Tate's thing. And his nonsense has led him to being banned from several major social media platforms like TikTok and Facebook and Instagram. Now, Tristan Tate, his brother, has built a similar online presence, often appearing alongside his brother Andrew. Now, the brothers have also been at the center of multiple criminal investigations around the world, really. They're already facing separate criminal proceedings in Romania, where prosecutors have accused them of human trafficking, trafficking of minors, sexual intercourse with a minor, money laundering, and forming an organized criminal group. The Tates have denied those allegations, and they maintain that they are innocent. But now they're facing even more legal trouble. This week, prosecutors in the UK announced 38 additional criminal charges involving four new alleged victims. Now, those new allegations include rape, arranging or facilitating trafficking for sexual exploitation, assault, and in Andrew Tate's case, additional charges involving alleged indecent images of a child and extreme pornography. Now, those new charges bring the total number of charges that the brothers face in the UK to 59, involving seven alleged victims. Now, following those new charges, U.S. Marshals arrested the brothers in Miami on an extradition warrant. So they're currently being held in Florida while they fight extradition to the United Kingdom, where prosecutors want them returned to stand trial. So a federal judge will ultimately decide whether the legal requirements for extradition have been met before they can be transferred overseas. I say let them go. Get them out of here. But we'll see what happens. All right, let's move on to trials to watch. Now, one of the biggest trials getting underway this week, and one that we'll be watching very closely, is the Lindsay Clancy case. Now, if you missed last week's court report, Clancy is the Massachusetts mother accused of killing her three young children in January of 2023. The defense contends that she was suffering from severe postpartum psychosis brought on by a combination of mental illness and prescribed medications, while prosecutors argue the killings were intentional and carefully planned. Now, this week, the court completed the difficult process of selecting a jury, which paves the way for opening statements that are scheduled to begin on Monday. The trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks and is likely to feature very emotional testimony, extensive medical evidence, and a battle between experts over Lindsay Clancy's mental state at the time of the killings. Now, this is going to be one of the biggest and most closely watched trials of the year, and it's one that I will be following from start to finish. So expect weekly updates here on Court Report, and as always, if there are any major developments, then I will break those down in more detail in a full episode. Let's move on to appeals and legal twists. Scott Peterson is back in the headlines more than two decades after he was convicted of murdering his wife, Lacey Peterson, and their unborn son, Connor. This is a case that's always been personal to me. I dedicated two episodes of 13th Juror to it, one breaking down the prosecution's case and one laying out the defense's case. Now, if you've listened to those episodes, you know that this has stayed with me ever since it happened. Lacey disappeared on my birthday, and by the time her and Connor's remains were found, I had just learned that I was pregnant with my own son. The thought that Lacey never got the chance to hold her little boy affected me in a way that I can't really put into words, and it's actually the reason that I named my own son after him. My son's middle name is Connor. Now, this case is back in the spotlight after A&E released a new two-part documentary, Scott Peterson, The New Evidence, which revisits the conviction and highlights arguments from Peterson's legal team and the Los Angeles Innocence Project. The documentary discusses several claims, including questions about eyewitness sightings of Lacey, updated analysis of tidal movements in the San Francisco Bay, forensic evidence, and the long-debated theory that Lacey may have interrupted a burglary near her home before she disappeared. Now, Peterson's attorneys argue that those issues deserve a new look and could undermine confidence in the jury's verdict. But legally, none of that changes where the case stands today. Earlier this year, a California judge rejected Scott Peterson's latest petition for a new trial, ruling that the defense's claims were either procedurally barred, lacked merit, or had already been considered by the courts. Peterson remains convicted and is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Now, his attorneys have said that they plan to continue appealing that ruling. So the documentary has definitely reignited debate online, with some viewers questioning whether Scott Peterson received a fair trial, and others arguing that it simply repackages theories that have already been rejected by multiple courts. So while the public conversation has certainly been revived, the legal picture has not been changed, at least not yet. We'll be right back.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, now for our top story. We move on to cases making headlines. And this one has been all over all of the headlines all week long. Now, this week, we saw a preliminary hearing for 21-year-old platinum-selling musician David Anthony Burke, better known as David. That's D and then a 4 instead of an A, VD, if you want to look him up. Now, this was the first real opportunity for prosecutors to begin laying out the evidence that they say connects him to the killing of 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez. And if you aren't familiar with this case, or if you just need a refresher, this is a really difficult one, y'all. Celeste was only 13 years old and in the 7th grade when her family first reported her missing as a runaway in early 2024. She had reportedly run away on Valentine's Day and then again the following month, but both times she returned home within just a few days. Then in April, Celeste disappeared again, and this time she never came home. Now, her family searched desperately for answers. They met with investigators, reviewed surveillance footage, and followed every lead they could find. They even received one phone call from Celeste about a month after she disappeared. But after that, they said they never heard from her again. Nearly a year and a half later, investigators discovered the remains of a young girl inside the front trunk of an abandoned Tesla that had been sitting in the Hollywood Hills for about a month. Dental records confirmed the family's worst nightmare. It was Celeste. She was found just one day after what would have been her 15th birthday, and the Tesla belonged to David Burke. But prosecutors say that David's relationship with Celeste started years before she disappeared. So according to testimony, the two first met online in January of 2022, when Celeste was only 11 years old. Now, prosecutors allege that the relationship became sexual in November of 2023. At that point, David was like 18 years old, had just signed with a major record label, and was becoming a kind of like a rising star after his song Romantic Homicide reached the Billboard Hot 100. Now, Celeste was a 13-year-old girl in the seventh grade. And even after deputies went to David's home during one of the early missing persons investigations and informed him that Celeste was only 13 years old, prosecutors say he never ended the relationship. Now, a quick note on that. This was the first time when they went to his house. This was the first time that she disappeared. It was that Valentine's Day. And her family had told police that she had a boyfriend named David, but they didn't know much about him. So police used her phone records to find the phone number and locate David and called him and went and talked to him. He showed them the missing persons flyer that he pulled up on his phone, and it had her picture from sixth grade, which, remember, was just a year before that. And he pulled it up and he was like, yeah, I thought she was 18. She told me she was 18. I didn't know that she was only 13 until, you know, I saw this. So that was his story. Now, she did return home after that. And after she returned home, Celeste's parents confiscated her phone. But then investigators say that David, knowing she's only 13, even if he thought she was 18 before, now he knows that she's only 13, that she's a child, and investigators say that David still bought her a burner phone after this and even paid one of her classmates $1,000 to secretly deliver it to her so that they could continue communicating. Now, what prosecutors presented next was hundreds of text messages between the two, and those messages painted a heartbreaking picture of this quote-unquote relationship. Now, they revealed that when Celeste was just 13 years old, she became pregnant. And according to the messages, both she and David believed that he was the father, but agreed that neither of them was capable of raising a baby. So Celeste ultimately had an abortion. Now, in later conversations, she expressed a deep kind of like regret over that decision. She wrote that she felt guilty because she had taken, quote unquote, the life of a literal baby. Now, the messages also showed that Celeste wanted more from their relationship. At one point, she told David that all they ever did was hang out and have sex and that she wanted something more meaningful. And she asked him whether anyone knew they were sleeping together. And according to prosecutors, David told her no, that he wanted to keep it that way until they were married. And y'all, I want to be really clear right here because Celeste is referring to what was happening as sex, but she was still a child. She was only 13 years old. And at that age, she was not legally capable of consenting to a sexual relationship with an adult. So I know that she's referring to it as sex, but I just wanted to throw that in there. Now, the hearing also revealed just how intertwined their lives had become. Prosecutors introduced airline records showing David purchased tickets for the two of them to travel together. I guess he wanted to take her out of town to meet his family. This is shortly after Celeste turned 14 years old. She traveled with David to Texas, where she met members of his family, before the two later traveled together to London. Now, the court was also shown photographs and videos recovered from David's phone showing the two kissing, embracing, and lying together in bed. And investigators also documented matching tattoos. So Celeste had David tattooed in red ink on her ring finger, and David had Celeste tattooed in red ink on his ring finger. And prosecutors pointed out a chilling detail here. When Celeste's remains were recovered, the finger where her tattoo had been located had been cut off and has never been recovered. That's terrifying. Now, some of the most emotional testimony came when investigators described evidence the judge could not allow to be displayed in court. Prosecutors say that they recovered more than 36 explicit photographs and videos from David's iPhone depicting the sexual abuse of Celeste while she was only 13 and 14 years old. Now, because those images constitute child sexual abuse material, they were not shown in court. Instead, an investigator had to describe them for the court. And as he did, Celeste's mom began crying while her father kind of like looked down at the ground. And eventually, both parents got up and left the courtroom. Prosecutors say that the relationship eventually began to fall apart. In one text message from November of 2024, Celeste wrote, "I literally had sex with you for almost a year straight." And David responded that she was acting like this was their first breakup when, according to him, it was actually their eighth breakup. Prosecutors believe that those messages showed the growing tension between the two. And then everything kind of came to a head on April 22nd of 2025. Prosecutors say that Celeste threatened to expose their relationship and reveal what had been happening between them, which is something that they argued David believed would destroy both his career and his future. So the very next day after this argument, prosecutors say that David ordered an Uber to pick up Celeste from her hometown and bring her to his Hollywood Hills home. The surveillance footage allegedly captured her arriving, and then text messages show the two communicating until she reached the house. And after that, her phone went silent. Prosecutors say that she was never seen or heard from again. And the state then walked the court through what they believed happened next. On April 24th, the day after prosecutors believe Celeste was killed, David purchased a shovel from Home Depot. About a week later, he ordered two chainsaws, a cadaver body bag, a heavy-duty laundry bag, and an 8-foot inflatable pool from Amazon. Then, on May 4th, he purchased a third chainsaw from Home Depot and had it delivered to his house through Uber Postmates. And y'all, this part's wild to me. Think about how many trials we've watched where prosecutors show surveillance footage of an alleged killer buying shovels and bleach and plastic totes or cleaning supplies. We've seen that over and over again. But having the chainsaw prosecutors believe was used to dismember the victim delivered to your front door by Uber Postmates, that's a first for me. But leave it to Hollywood. Now, records also show David purchased a mop and a bucket that same day, and prosecutors believe that he later set up the inflatable pool inside his garage and used that while dismembering Celeste's body. 2 months later, investigators say he ordered what was described as a burn cage from Amazon along with a fireproof mat, but the burn cage was still unopened when investigators searched his home. Now, Celeste's autopsy determined that she died from multiple stab wounds. Her arms and legs had been dismembered into multiple pieces, and investigators also found tiny flecks of blue plastic on her body, which prosecutors believe came from that inflatable pool that was delivered to David's house. Now, finding Celeste inside David's Tesla was one thing, but prosecutors still had to show that David was the person who drove that Tesla to the location where it was abandoned. So to do that, they relied on digital evidence. Now, surveillance cameras captured the Tesla leaving the area around David's home on July 29th, 2025. Records show David's phone connected to the Tesla around that same time before disconnecting at 2:18 that afternoon. Then, just 2 minutes later, another surveillance camera captured David walking back toward his house. Now, the Tesla had been parked less than a quarter of a mile away, literally like a block and a half from his home. And automated license plate readers mounted on LAPD patrol cars continued detecting that car in that exact location from July 29th all the way up until September 8th, which is when the car was towed and Celeste's remains were finally discovered. So prosecutors devoted a lot of time also to David's finances. Now, executives from Interscope Records testified that David had already earned somewhere between $10 and $11 million and had contracts that could have earned him another $17 million or more. And prosecutors argued that when Celeste threatened to expose their relationship, David believed that he stood to lose all of that. And that's why they're pushing the special circumstance allegation that the murder was committed for financial gain. Now, the hearing also revealed something else that had not been previously public. After Celeste's death, prosecutors disclosed that David had already been under investigation for alleged sexual acts involving a child under the age of 14, and that Celeste herself was a witness in that investigation. And prosecutors now allege that David killed her not only for financial gain, but to prevent her from testifying. David was arrested in April 2026 and charged with first-degree murder, along with special circumstance allegations of lying in wait, financial gain, and murdering a witness to a criminal investigation. He's also charged with sexual acts involving a child under 14 and mutilation of human remains. So if convicted, prosecutors have said that they intend to seek the maximum punishment allowed by law, which in this case could mean life in prison without the possibility of parole or even the death penalty. Now, remember, a preliminary hearing is not a trial. The judge is not deciding whether David is guilty or not. At this stage, prosecutors only have to establish probable cause. That is, enough evidence to show that a crime was likely committed and that David likely committed it. So if you listen to my Tyler Robinson episode, this is the exact same process we talked about there. Cameras weren't allowed inside the courtroom, so I pieced all of this testimony together from reporters who were there, including my friend Lauren Conlin. Now, if you're looking for really detailed day-by-day updates from inside the courtroom, I highly recommend following Lauren on X. She's been in the courtroom covering this hearing firsthand, and she's done an excellent job reporting on the testimony as it happens. You can find her at Conlin_Lauren on X. The hearing will continue this week, and I will keep y'all posted on updates. So that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to FinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
FinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit FinQuest.com for more details.